This is a football fans podcast from the people behind CelticUnderground.net. Thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to it. And we're like buses. Don't have any for 3 weeks, and now three come along at once. Now, you're listening to a Celtic fans podcast, and you therefore no doubt read things like Facebook, Twitter, and various other Celtic fans websites online, possibly listen to By the Min Tims, Fritz the Grand Old Team, 90 Minute Cynic, 20 Minute Tims, all the Celtic fans podcasts, homeboys, whatever. None of us would be here if it wasn't for the people who this podcast is about, if it wasn't for Not The View. For those of you younger, imagine a podcast with the words all written down and then printed out in pieces of paper. That's a fanzine. And the fanzines were around long before internet bandpots. And as I say, internet bandpots wouldn't have existed if it wasn't for the fanzines. In fact, there was a bit more humour in the fanzines, and sometimes appears, and I can be as guilty as anyone, on appears on the web. There was the famous biscuit tin, and they embarrassed the hoops, and bad haircuts, and it was like a private eye version of the Celtic View. Anyway, it started 30 years ago, so it's the 30th anniversary of Not The View. They had a wee thing for it, and St Anthony of this parish went along and chatted to the guys. So that's this podcast. Before St Anthony, I've got some audio with Brendan prior to the Bayern Munich game. And then after St Anthony, I've got a wee bit of audio of Boyata from the press conference for the Bayern Munich game. If you are interested in doing anything for the foundation, if I can get the words out, there is still enough time to register for the sleep out. It's getting pretty tight, but if you register for the sleep out, which is the weekend of 11th, 12th of November, you can do that. And then, of course, there is the Founding Fathers Fast on the 6th of November, and there is the Mass in St Mary's on the 6th of November to commemorate the 130th anniversary of our club. Anyway, enough of me. I'm going to pass over to first Brendan Rodgers and then St Anthony with the Not The View guys.
Certainly look to find a way to be competitive, and look to see if we can get a result. Of course, it's like it is for most teams, you know, when you play away against Bayern Munich, it's very tough. But there was moments in the game, in particular the second half, where you could see our confidence and belief in how we were playing come through, and that allowed us to then be much more like ourselves. So, but we're playing at home. We always, you know, love to play here, the backing of the support, and looking to then, like I say, find a way to get a result, and it's something that we'll be looking to do tomorrow evening.
No Lewandowski, no Müller. How much do you take from that? How much encouragement for the players?
Well, of course, there's two players that are world-class players and have been consistently now for a number of years. You know, Lewandowski is one of the world's best strikers with his movement, his speed, and the quality, and he's been consistently doing that now for a few years. And Müller's a player that I've always loved in terms of wherever he's played, you know, whether it be as a striker, wide in the right, or like he did against us, he played as a sort of advanced midfield player. He's a very gifted player, And like I say, his will and desire to play well is always there. So those two players, of course, will be a miss for them. But there's some very good players behind that to come in, like Jaime Rodriguez, who came in and scored in one of the last few games. So listen, they're a talented team. They're set up. And they've been put together to win this competition. So we know the magnitude of the test, but one that we'll really relish.
Brendan, you may have seen the quotes from Karl-Heinz Rummenigge with regards to Lewandowski's absence. Is that the kind of thing that can only fire your team up? The fact that they're clearly not prioritising this game and they're prioritising the weekend's game instead?
Yeah, someone showed me something on that. Listen, we respect that they're a very good side. It's up to us in terms of how we work. All we can do is control what we can. So whatever Bayern Munich's intentions are, I have the utmost respect for them and their team. And for us, it's about us earning the respect at this level, hopefully, over the next few years. And for that, you have to perform well.
Do you feel that... maybe not so much the game 2 weeks ago, but the game here against PSG is the one that the players will want to improve on, because I guess Bayern Munich are up in that upper echelon of the best teams in Europe. And you know, speaking to a few of the guys after the PSG game here, they were disappointed that they didn't play as well on that big stage here at Celtic Park.
Yeah, well, listen, we've had a few games like you see the PSG first half performance, we could be much better first half out in Bayern, but I think that's more a belief, and that's something for me in my time here, having to convince, my job is to convince the players that they can go and really be competitive in how we play at that level. Now that's a very, very difficult thing to do, because they're playing against, you know, players that a lot of the time they have greater speed and their techniques at a top level, and they've been consistently at that level for a reason. But like I say, that's my job, to convince the players that we can go and work that way and play it how we want to play, and as opposed to sitting back and, I hear this great word, pragmatic, that gets used all the time. And it normally comes from people, like I say, who don't have a commitment to anything. You know, they don't have a commitment to play a certain way. They just think you can chop and change on a daily basis of how you work. But not the case. We look to improve our ideas of football, and we look to improve those against the very best teams, and we'll always look to find a way to do that.
To what extent, Brendan, do you feel the players have a belief
you can win tomorrow? Yeah, we always have a great confidence, in particular at home in this competition. Like I say, we've got a victory, and at this point, I think last term people were saying that we were improving and doing better. Well, we have more points at this stage, but it doesn't take away from our overall aim, and our aim in the competition is to be in European football. We're playing against, you know, two superpowers of the world game at the moment, and two exceptional teams in their different ways, and we've Anderlecht, two of the Belgian champions in our league, and we've performed very, very well against them. So for us tomorrow night, we want to get a result. You know, we have to show that we have the qualities to do that, and we always look and think we have a great chance at home.
Is there anything you've seen recently, Brendan, that gives you that feeling that you can go into this against a winnable match, given it's not that long since Bayern were in back-to-back Champions League finals?
Yeah, it's the learning that comes from that. If you think of the last game that we played, it was a tough game for us, but we showed in spells in that some of our qualities. If we then go into our two games after that, of course it's a different level of player you're playing against, but you know, we played in our league game away at Aberdeen, and the level that we played at, you know, we gained that confidence from playing in parts of how we did against Bayern Munich. So yeah, it's a further few weeks on, and this is a group of players that have been constantly learning, constantly developing in the 17 months I've been here, and for us this is a great stage for us to develop as a team, and it's something that we hope that we can do again further tomorrow evening.
Is that something that you stress, that this is such a great stage, it'd be a shame to not perform, in other words to try and get the players to enjoy and to push themselves on as much as they can?
No, I think it's like, listen, it's natural. It's not that they don't want to perform. You've got to consider that there's two teams. Like I've always said, as much as we want to perform, you get a world class team that you're playing against, and they play very, very well. That can be difficult to stop, you know. So, but we have to find a way. That's what we aim to do. And can we find a different way? But that'll be the aim for tomorrow. But it's never for the want of the players not want to do it. You know, my players are as honest a group of players as you come across. They give everything into their work. They're super professional. They've shown the consistency domestically. They've shown that they are grown at this level, having been out in it for a few years. And we have a lot of young players that are gaining invaluable experience from it. So it takes time. But we hope that somewhere very soon we can make a big result. You know, we had a great performance against Man City here last year. That were a team that were doing exceptionally well, and we just failed to get that victory. So, that's what we're searching for at this level.
You've got two strikers both on form at the moment. You've managed to give them both game time within out games. But when it comes to the crunch, a big game like this, is it a very tough decision who to keep happy, who to play?
It's not about keeping happy. It's about finding the best team that you think can deliver the result. It's always the toughest job for a coach or a manager. They'll always tell you that, you know, and especially here when we're at Celtic, we've got 25 players giving their all every single day, and of course they want to play in the big games. So whichever one I play, it'll be what I think is the team that can get us the result. And all the players respect that. You know, they're a very spirited group. They always know that I give them an honest chance, and I always speak to them honestly in terms of where they're at. But ultimately, it's about finding a team for every game that we play in order to allow us to get a result.
Do you think that the general lack of opposition in the Championship during the whole year is a problem, or makes the learning slower for your team to play against the biggest teams in Europe?
Yeah, it can be difficult, of course, because you're going from one level, of course, to and you're not just jumping one level, you're jumping two or three levels, especially when you come into Champions League, because you're, like I say, you're normally pitched in, or we have been in these last couple of years with teams that are favourites for winning it. But look at the game at the weekend, you know, Bayern Munich beat Red Bull Leipzig, you know, 2-0, and the development and the finances that go into Red Bull, you know, another team. So it's always going to be difficult for us in terms of what we're at domestically in relation to making that jump. But we always have to find a way. We can't just accept that. We always have to try and find a way in order for us to continually improve.
It's been quite a run of games, from the semi-final to the game at Aberdeen, and then equaling the record at the weekend. How do the pressures in this one differ from those games, and how different a mental preparation is it for tomorrow night?
Not too different. They're all big games, and when you're Celtic, you go in with the ambition to win every game that you play. Of course, you're respecting the opponent in terms of what you're playing, but that's what we do every game, you know, and we feel that, you know, that this is a game that we want to go into and perform well in, and if we can do that, we believe that we can get a result. But like I say, since I've come in here, every game that we've had over 17 months, there's always been a narrative to it. There's always been something that surrounds it being a big game. But when you play and work for Celtic, and you have that expectation, like I say, you don't need to build any pressure into the games any more or less, because you want to succeed in every game you play. And for us, we want to do well in this competition, and we want to consistently improve. And for that, that means going and performing. So, been a great run of games that we're in. Saturday I made some changes, and I think the supporters here understand that every now and then, you know, I see my job here is to develop young players, to put young players in the team, and we had a lot of positives from Saturday, even though we drew the game. You know, a lot of players getting game time that we may need at some part of the season. Young Mikey Johnson playing, he was 18 and he was terrific. And I think the supporters here see that we're trying to develop a football club and not just a cycle of 6 weeks of trying to win games to stay in a job. We're trying to evolve everything here at the club. And like I say, we now come into this game and it's another great game for us.
How's your squad looking from Saturday? Obviously, Roberts is out. Jam, how's he? Is he going to make it at all?
Yeah, he's fine. He trains. So, obviously, Pat is a disappointment for us. So we're hoping he can get back as quick as he can.
And obviously, you've got a few issues defensively still with the first choice central defenders who you've usually gone to. Do you have a different plan?
I've got loads of plans.
Yeah. After what happened in Munich, have you got alternatives out there, given that you're thin on the ground in numbers? Or
no, we're okay. We're okay. They were just very good. They were just very, very good. So we have to accept that sometimes, and look to find a different way of maybe getting the result.
Ask that question in a different way. As one of the players who's learned most under you, would it be Nir Beaton, because he's learning a new position? And has he maybe even surprised you with the way he's come on? And I'm wondering if he's in your thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Nir Beaton seems to only get mentioned if he makes a mistake, and he makes very few. And I think that's the mark of how good he's been. You know, he's a player that stepped in and right the way through a qualification phase of this competition where we didn't have a hardly centre-half available. He stepped in and was absolutely brilliant for us. Okay, he, like the team, had a little spell of 20 minutes in Astana where there was a bit of vulnerability there. But that's only natural. I've seen top-class centre-halves have that. He stepped into the team and played at centre-half when we needed him. And he played in a game last week against Aberdeen where he was outstanding. And like I say, there's a little bit of biasness towards him, which some people look to try and confirm that he's not a centre-half. But he's a guy that's developed in that role. Yeah, he's not perfect, but now there's a lot of players. But what he's done for us and done for the team, I think we all hugely respect. And if I didn't think he could play there in any of the games, I wouldn't play him. But he's improving his defensive mentality, because when you step in there, that has to be first and foremost your idea. But then it gives us that ability to play and build our game from behind. And like I say, he's been exceptionally good at it.
Brendan, just finally, we've talked so much about the record in the last week or so, and you touched on it when you equaled it on Saturday. Is there anything at all you feel that the players can take from what they've achieved there into a game like this? Or is the step up just so great that it's almost a completely different ball game that you're talking about here?
Yeah, well, I think the first part is that they can take huge pride in equaling it. You know, if you actually sit down and think about it, you know, 100 years since that record, anyone's went near that. And then so for them to match that, and that's a real testament to their mentality, to their work, their professionalism. And coaches and managers and players will tell you that you can have off days, but these players have shown that even at that, they've had the will to and the quality to get the results. And then in terms of the numbers themselves, the actual number of wins they've had, and very few draws in that period. It's a remarkable statistic, and of course they take great confidence from that. You know, you go into this level of competition, of course it's a different level altogether. But in both there's great experiences, and they're both process of which you learn in. And this is the great thing of this team: they're constantly evolving and getting better. But the equaling that record was absolutely a phenomenal achievement by them, and the aim is to continue and push and stretch that for as much as we possibly can.
Thank you very much.
It's my great pleasure to be joined today on the latest podcast with three of Not the View's finest
We have Average Joe Miller, we've got Jerry Dunbar, and we have Andy Murdoch. And we're going to go over the origins of the fanzine, how it came to light, and how it expanded to become what it is today. It's the 30th anniversary, and it really deserves a podcast on its own to go over the origins of the fanzine. So let's just start at the very beginning. How did the fanzine come about, and how did it start?
The origin was at the end of the 86-87 season. The last Celtic home game of the season was Celtic against Falkirk, and we lost. It was Davy Hayes' last home game in charge, and we used to meet regularly. Bunches used to meet regularly in the Horseshoe Bar, and the usual greeting meeting was taking place after that. And the complaints were about, you know, the how bad a state we were in and why that was never reflected in the view. And somebody came up with the idea, well, if you think it's that bad, why don't we do one ourselves? And that's basically where the idea came from. And so George of the Jungle and myself decided to do it, and that's where the idea came from. And so it was a very kind of cut and paste total.
Is it fair to say that the first edition was fairly basic?
I think that's doing it much more credit than it actually deserves.
When he says cut and paste, he actually means with scissors.
Literally.
Doesn't mean the computer version.
It was literally like that. But the first edition didn't come out till the start of the season following. Mm-hmm. And the first edition was 1988 season, the centenary season.
August 87.
August 87, and it was the Billy Stark game. Mm-hmm. So by that time, George and myself had put together 16 pages of cutting, basically sack the board, and that was the strap line, sack the board. And we'd managed to photocopy 500 of them, and they were sold out in Jane Field Street within about 10 minutes.
It's worth pointing out that the name Not the View, the younger people might not be familiar with that, but Not the 9 o'clock news.
That's correct, yeah.
This Not thing was a buzz phrase at the time, yep. So that was quite an original concept, because as you said there, the View towed the line, the party line, but obviously you could be a wee bit more irreverent, yeah. And a wee bit more humorous.
I think quite a few amongst us had actually written letters to the View. But they never ever got published. Every letter that was in the View was, if you wrote a letter that said hats off to Jack McGinn, I think you're doing a grand job, it was getting published. But anything else was basically in the bin. Mm-hmm. So it was an outlet for people who had an alternate view to Jack McGinn and his, mm-hmm. his cronies.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to a guy, and he was saying that we can be quite proud, because Not the View, my recollection is anyway, and I was in my early 20s at the time, was the first fanzine that I ever remember coming out. I don't remember any team that beat us there, even down in England. Now, somebody made a good point actually, and we need to pay a bit of homage here. The Shamrock came out in
absolutely,
the 60s.
Yeah.
And right. It ran from 63 to the Scottish Cup in 65, yep. And I think when Big Jock came, as far as I know, or I can make out, that they decided not to go any further because their job was done. You know, the great days were coming, and there wasn't any need to protest.
Yep.
But you know, I remember going to the Strathclyde programme shop in Renfield Street above the Athol Arms, mm-hmm. And I said to the guy behind the counter, what's that thing up there, Not the View? And he says, it's a fanzine. Nobody knew what a fanzine was. So he let me see it, and I had a wee look at it, and it looked funny, and it looked, as I said, irreverent, and all the things that you're looking for. And I thought, oh, we'll take a copy of that. And I always compare it to, you'll appreciate this joke, because I know you're in your music. You know that way that if you like a band and then they become commercial, you feel kind of con, don't you? Because you're like, I remember seeing them, and there was only 30 people watched them, right? Well, I feel a bit like that with Not the View, because I was talking to people about it, and they're going, I've not got a clue what you're talking about. And I would show them this wee copy I had. And they would say, oh, where can you get one of them? And you know, did you sell out the first one?
Yeah, within 10 minutes.
Well, it's funny what you should say
about the Shamrock, because I went up to the Mitchell Library and I dug out whatever they have up there. It's in a big binder kind of thing. And some of the stuff, a lot of the stuff that they were writing about, these guys, was exactly the same stuff that was in Not the View. They were hammering the board. They were complaining about the state of the stadium and all the rest of it. It was quite a continuous kind of timeline of that. The attitude of the board in 1964 1963 when the Shamrock was going around. The board's attitude hadn't changed much to 1987,
1988. Mm-hmm. The thing about fanzines and all that as well, there was always people that into their music, into like Sniffing Glue and all that, when punk came about and all that, and there was always an alternative there. And when Naughty View, I remember seeing the first issue and going, fuck, where's this been? You know, this is just exactly what we've been asking for, as a support, to vent my feelings somewhere. And I got in touch with the guys, and it was just like, it was just right up my street, like many other just normal punters.
There was never a kind of culture, I think, before that, where people, ordinary folk, thought that they could do it themselves. It was the newspapers were you know,
the mainstream stuff.
Aye. Absolutely, but there was no alternative to that. The Times, the Citizen, the Record, the Express, all these titles that were around at the time. That's where people got their football news from, and all the rest of it. And there was never any. I certainly didn't grow up thinking that ordinary folk could write for that. I always thought you had to be quote unquote trained in order to do that. And Jimmy Sanderson, remember him? He always claimed that he was a trained journalist. That was his favourite phrase. I mean, whatever that means.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I remember the first time I even saw the magazine, which was in Celtic game during an Aberdeen game, and he said to the guy, where did you pick this up? Oak sold it to me in a bar. And I'm looking at it going, how do we get this? And Jerry's always quite bitter. The first one I ever got was free, because we wrote off the PO box and said, can you give us more information? We got a free magazine back. He's never got the 50
pence. You're lucky you got a reply, to be honest.
Only 50 pence.
Ask the guys for more than 90 minutes, they still bleat about that.
Well, you know, it was groundbreaking stuff, because for the first time the fans had a collective voice, and you could write into Naughty View and they would print it, because if it was critical, because the Celtic View wouldn't print it. So I remember how quickly it caught on, because, you know, the first one was a bit of a first couple maybe were cult issues, and then the three or four, everybody'd heard it, and you know, you must have grown pretty quickly.
But you don't know that when you start it up. You don't know how many people you're kind of reaching out to, or you don't know how many people are going to buy into the idea. It might have just, you know, might have been 500 people at the time. It might have been more than that, as it turned out. You know, actually turned out to be more than that. But you don't know. You just know that all the guys that were sitting in the pub that night were of a like mind, and it wasn't being reflected either in the mainstream, like you mentioned, or, more importantly, the Celtic View. Now, if you think about why the Celtic View was started, which is actually a very good idea, you know, the club itself isn't its image or its philosophy isn't being reflected in the mainstream. So Jack McGinn comes up with this idea, which is actually a very good one, of okay, then we'll do our own magazine or our own newspaper, and it will come out every Wednesday. Great idea. But then it becomes, you know, by that time, 20 years later, it has become just Pravda. That's but what it was.
To be fair to the Celtic View, it is the Celtic View, and they are constrained by what they can put in it. But I think that,
yeah, but my question would be, why should it reflect the views of the board, or should it reflect the views of the supporters? That was what we were basically
saying. The point I'm making is that they can't put in anything offensive to any other teams. You can't accuse like Graham Roberts of being a dirty hun so and so, whereas in Naughty View, like you could tear right into him and there's no comeback. So
there should have always been a place in the Celtic View for criticism of what was going on now, because a lot of stuff we'd done was like, typical hun stuff and laughing at them and all. But then the serious side as well that we were complaining about, because we were there every week combing away like everybody else, we were complaining about what was happening to our club. So if you can't express that through the official channels, which we should have been allowed to do, we wouldn't be sitting here talking right now.
You're making a good point, because for the first time I remember thinking that there's actually fellow like-minded Celtic fans and a groundswell of opinion against the board the way I feel, right? And it was quite sort of enlightening to think that there was other people out there, because it's one thing going into the pub with your pals and saying, seeing that board of directors, how can we get short of them? They're rotten, they're holding us back, you know, the stadium's in a terrible state, we need investment, there's people out there obviously wanting to put money in, how can we do it? Now, you have your couple of pints and then you go up the road and forget about it, but for the first time there was a forum where guys could get together in unison and say, well, do you know, how can we take this forward? And you guys were at the vanguard of that at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. So there was never an idea of where it was going to end up or what to do. I mean, I think everybody just realised that what was happening was unacceptable and just couldn't go on much longer.
So as I said, I bought the first one in the programme shop, and I remember sort of the fuss about it and all the rest of the stuff. But improvements come along. It wasn't long before you colour covers and things like that. So
about 20 years that took. It was one colour cover. There was only one colour cover. It was a Christmas issue, and the price went up to £1 just to pay for the colour cover. But a colour covers was a radical.
That was kind of Martin Hale's season.
Was it?
That was fairly.
The point I want to make is that it improved very, very swiftly. You know, for going to, for the basic, you know, just cut and paste material. It looked a good read and it was well produced. So was that something you were conscious of?
No, it was a case of, you know, the first one was done in a typewriter, which was borrowed, quote unquote, for work. In fact, somebody lent me it or gave me it or something. But then, you know, then it was an Amstrad computer with a daisy wheel printer. And then it was, these things are museums now. And then it was an Amstrad computer, and then it was a Mac, an old Mac. You should have seen it. I've still got it in the garage somewhere, I think.
Photoshop and all that was just coming into play that was just coming.
You should have seen the things that Joe used to do. He used to work in a place where, in order to get a picture in the magazine, it was a Heath Robinson type of thing. You cranked something up, and it's like Frankenstein, and then electricity was starting, and lightning bolts.
It started the crossover, the dark room going into a computer. Mm-hmm. You know, basically that was it. So you're in that dark room trying to get all these pictures and all that together and all that. But it's Jerry saying, we still tried to keep it looking like a fanzine. Mm-hmm. You know, we did kind of make it go up a couple of steps, but you see, we didn't want it to become glossy. We didn't want it to turn into anything other than kind of a street thing.
Keep it
a street thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's been true to that. We used to sit and have meetings during the week about what we were going to put in it.
We used to meet in a pub and get pissed.
Right, and honestly, it was ridiculous. We'd be sitting with stacks of stuff, and Jerry and I would be sitting across the table, swallowing like hen. Right, this, we've got to do this and all that. And then we'd get home at 2:00. I'd phone him up the next day and go, I can't remember a thing we'll meant to be doing. What's this picture all about? What am I meant to be doing?
Organised chaos.
And it was basically like that, and we ended up saying we had to stop it. But
things that you can do these days are instantaneous. Mm-hmm. If you want to put any kind of picture on the web tomorrow, or on your blog, or on your Twitter website feed, or something like that, you can do it in a minute.
It's instantly global.
We had to organise it a week or two in advance.
So. I actually was clearing out something in my house the other day, and I came across preliminary notes that I'd made for an article that I'd, one of the first ones I ever wrote, and it was handwritten. And I remember actually handing it in to Jerry, handwritten, so he would then have to take them, because now you just email it. Mm-hmm. I used to hand in handwritten stuff, like handing in your homework, and he would then have to go and type that all up. That's where it was at that point.
I know some of the things, like putting somebody's head on a body. That was a major job. You know, you're just on your. Some people can do that on their phones.
Lee Harvey Oswald. That's not Oliver Stone documentary.
The one I always remember, cover wise, was it must have been one of the earlier ones, and it was a wee boy at the front with the hoops, and it says, "My dad is away fighting the Huns, and we're fighting the Huns at home."
I still use that wee guy.
He's become the emblem, hasn't he?
Absolutely.
Through the years, which is funny to think, you know, all the years later that he's still there. So in terms of numbers, then you had 500 at the beginning. After maybe 6, 7, 8 issues, and it is the centenary season, and thank God we had a good season, and there was a lot of momentum at the time. In terms of numbers, were you conscious of the fact that you were having to print more and more?
Yep, absolutely. And you know, I think it reached its peak one Christmas issue. I'm not sure if it was that season or the season after, where it was, I asked the printer about this the other day, and I said it was 12,000. He said no, it was 20,000.
Oof. Yeah, that's astonishing.
Really true. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't know what happened to the money, but
it was 50p.
Yeah. But even so, you know, it was incredible. Mm-hmm. That's in terms of the amount of people that were going at the time, it's worth pointing out,
amazing. Especially the younger guys that listen to this, just how popular fanzines had to be, because these days, as you say, they're even the websites, you just go on it right away, and you can go on all these websites, it touch you a button, you know. And in those days, you had to actively go and purchase your copy, and you could read it in the supporters bus, you could read it back in the house, and all the rest of this stuff. But there's one wee point I want to make. I don't know if you're aware of this. I had a mate in work, and he used to like buying fanzines for various clubs, even down in England and things like that. And he brought in one day called the Chelsea Independent. Mm. So I had a wee look
at it. I remember that one.
Chelsea, and it was, I have to say, it was a good read. It was a sensible fanzine. It wasn't one of these sort of like horrible ones with full of like bile and stuff. It was a good read, and it was obviously sensible people that were producing it. And it was an end of season issue, and they had a poll, and it was like, what was your favourite Chelsea game? Who was the Chelsea player of the season? And one of the last questions was, apart from the Chelsea Independent, which other fanzines do you read, right? And not the View finished above fall. And a Chelsea fanzine, which I thought at the time was astonishing. Mm-hmm. But I think it also goes to show the reputation that you built very, very quickly. That A, it's a good read. B, it's sensible. You're not going to get any nonsense in it. And C, it's funny, you know what I mean, some of the articles in, you must have got great contributors through the years.
Absolutely. Apart from these two, I mean, I remember one night standing outside Heritage, and a guy who recognised me for some reason, he said, "You do not the View, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "You won't know me," he says, "but I'm Chip Panheed." That was his nom de plume. And I said, you sent in a couple of letters and stuff, didn't you, Chip Panheed? But people were, you know, contributing freely and all that. Nowadays, I suppose the same guys would just, you know, put something on a forum or something, or put something on Quick News or something like that.
Somebody said their Twitter. I mean you, if you've got your wee Twitter account and you've maybe got a couple hundred followers, then you charge on, and then you can also correspond with guys who are coming back at you.
Yeah.
I got a complaint a few years ago. A guy was buying the magazine regular, and he said, "This is the last one I'm buying unless your rumours improve." And I had to say to him, "Mate, we're a printed magazine. Our stuff is out of date the second
it's printed."
Mm. You know, really, the internet's here. The rumours, and there's no point in us doing rumours anymore. Mm-hmm. They're ancient. Mm-hmm. So he never came back, actually. I maybe drove that one away. But that's the thing, the nature of what we do has changed. Mm-hmm. You know, at the start, there was Rumour Mill and Not the View, and it had all sorts of stuff in it, and that would be relatively current for the time, because these things moved a lot more slowly then. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it's a very much instantaneous world. If Tom Rogic gets a parking ticket in Glasgow, people in Melbourne know about it 10 minutes later.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So it's a very different world you're playing with, so you have to then tailor the magazine to that. So the format, not just the format, but the content is altered to reflect that.
Now, the one thing I think, if you said to Celtic fans, is if you mentioned Not the View, a word association, it would be they embarrassed the hoops. Right? It's amazing the number of people that I've spoken to through the years, and they go, "Do you remember Frank, the one he done about Frank Monroe? Do you remember the one he done about Roy Keane, all this, John Dowling, these kind of things?" So whose idea was that?
I wish I hadn't thought of it, but it was mine, and it's a bad idea. But I mean, you're young, you think you're smart, right? So you put that in. And we have had, you know, a lot of guys who weren't very good players who have played for Celtic, but nevertheless, you know, they've lived the dream kind of thing, you know.
Because I remember Danny Craney complained about Danny
Craney. That's right. That's what I'm saying. You know, that wasn't the worst one. That was bad
that
enough.
That was a total tongue.
But the worst one was I got an email from some woman in Australia who said, "I believe you published an article about my great grandfather or something in your magazine or something like that. Is there any chance that you could send me it?" And when I looked it up, it was
John Cirilla.
He appeared, I don't know who it was, I can't remember. I wouldn't mention his name anyway. But he had appeared, and so I didn't, he had appeared in that particular column, you know. And I didn't have the heart to actually reply to that one. You know. So I wish I'd never thought of that. But some of the ones that were in it were, when you read them, savage, but they're actually quite funny.
The one thing, I've made the point already, but there was a lot of humour in the view, which was part of the reason for having it, I suppose. But the other thing I think was important for the beginning, and I remember reading this in the first or second issue, that Irish politics weren't to be discussed. It was totally Celtic. There was other fans that took the Irish thing on board, and I think that's to your credit, because, you know, you can maybe the situation in Northern Ireland at the time was pretty bad, and you know, there was other forums for discussing those matters and politics in general, and I think it's to your credit that you made that right.
The fanzine world had kind of taken off by then. You know, there was a lot of other fanzines, as you say, that was a Chelsea one talking about Not a View. It was like, and you say follow, which they typically did, would follow everything we did, near enough, you know, and trying to do their own wee slant on it. There was the guy who started World Shut Your Mouth, the Rangers fanzine,
first one.
Go in touch with us before Follow was it. That guy was quite genuinely a decent bloke, but never kind of took off for him. He just didn't have enough bigotry in him, I don't think, to make it. And then you got the final hurdle and all that, Dundee United, go in touch.
Well, the one that
made it. So it's funny you say that, because I was actually, I've just been writing a thing for the magazine about 30 years, and the first editorial, it's quite open and say this may be the biggest piece of rubbish you've ever read in your life, in which case write in and make it better, which is a good good way to reel people in. But also says we'll print anything that's not religious, political, or this is a football fan, and it's basically, it sets its stall out very, very early on. That's page one. This is a football fan. If you want something else, start your own magazine, have it you, which people did. So great. You've got your own.
You led the way in that respect.
We certainly had our own political views as well, and a lot of them not a kick in the arse off of which Chuck L.R. and all the rest of them are doing. And another good read, I enjoy reading it, and it's got its own place, because that's what people want to read as well, because it does well, and I quite enjoy it. But for us, it wasn't for us, you know. Even though our political views were probably, well, I'm not similar, talking about the guys, similar, very similar.
The one fanzine title that I always remember at the time was Where the Creatures Meet. Now, you've been a music man, you must know that.
Where the Creatures Meet, that's
what team is it and what song is it?
Fuck's sake, man.
Is that Jim Morrison?
You're right. It's The Doors, and it's a song called Love Street, therefore that was the St Mirren fanzine. And I remember thinking at the time, that's how clever supporters can be. They can take these real left field ideas,
there,
and it's so
called
clever.
Brian Muir's head looks extraordinarily like the London Planetarium, and they cut it down to Brian Muir's head events. I can't remember what club that was.
Well, the Middlesbrough one was called Fly Me to the Moon, because at the time the manager was Bruce Rioch, and he said, if you were sent to the moon, which one player would you take with you? And he said Tony Mowbray.
But I used to get them all. We used to exchange a lot of them. You know, I don't know how many of them are still going.
Well, that was how the Sam Fowler thing started, was it not?
It started
to be distributed in Hamburg. And the lads out there sort of caught on to a couple of the magazines and got in touch with Jerry and started coming over here. That was how that whole thing kind of germinated, no pun intended.
In terms of each special issues, and the first one that sticks in my mind is the red card one, which I think was before Ibrox, the game at Ibrox.
That's right.
It's 2-1,
right? And that was the centenary season.
That's right.
Did Desby get sent off?
No one gets sent off.
Not that day, and it's funny because I used to go to Hamburg quite often, and I had seen that in the days when St Pauli were a very small team and there was hardly anybody there. And I went to the Milan tour, they were playing Armenia Bielefeld, I think, and there was a guy behind me, the terracing behind the goal, and there was a guy behind me, and he had a wee red card. Every time somebody did a foul against him, he would wee out this red card, and I thought, that's brilliant. There was one guy, and I thought, what would that be like if there was thousands? And if you remember that day at Ibrox,
that's right, there's a photo on the Celtic wicket,
the whole enclosure,
I don't know, but 5,000 guys holding up these red cards, and they've all bought a fanzine, obviously, to get the red card.
It was slightly bigger than the sort of like referee's red card. Guys were ripping them up. So where'd you get that? You know, and I'm having one of them, and there's thousands of them. But then there was another one, the St Patrick's Day Massacre, I think.
That's right. Yeah.
It might have been the game after that. We did the same thing.
And Nisbet didn't
get a red card.
That's why I'm getting confused.
And they were all in the jungle, thousands of them. It's hilarious. Brilliant.
But even that, people brought their own.
That's right.
It was even better. You know, they didn't even need to buy.
So the centenary season, you probably rode in the waves of the centenary season in some respects.
No, I think it's the other way around. I think Celtic won the league that year because
of you. I wouldn't disagree with you, but the difficult times came pretty quickly, and you did become there was a few fanzines at that time. I remember them. I mean, I'm sure we can go through them. Jungle Drums, didn't they last long? Two or three. And it was actually well produced, glossy cover, that kind of thing. Matt came along with One Sit-In, which formed into Alternative View, which is still in a go. What other ones was
there? There's one from the Airdrie buses, I can't remember what it was called. Over and Over.
Over and Over, I remember that one as well. And then you did more than 90 minutes for the Irish guys. Yeah. So quickly.
We don't get on with them though.
Oh, they were bitter enemies. We love them. We have a laugh at them. It's an ongoing fanzine war.
Right, the story is that he sent a letter in.
No, I was in fucking Lisbon for the Celtic game, and I turned up in the hotel waiting on the rest of my mates to arrive. So I seen Celtic men sitting in the bar, all Irish boys. I says, "All right, if I join you." "Aye, no bother." This guy's just staring at me, man. I'm like, "What's up, mate?" And he's going, "Fucking hate you guys." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And he's going, "Fucking not the View. I wrote a letter to you." It's Andy for more than 9 minutes. He says, "I wrote a letter to you. How did I start?"
Andy Mullen.
"Aye,
really?
Aye. How did I start a fanzine?" Blah blah blah. He's never fucking replied. Now I'll tell you what. Throw me another letter. We'll reply this time. So this is our constant.
I wasn't going to bring this up, but the lease came back in 1999 when Barnes was a manager. And you put a thing in with the fanzine that says, "If you've got any memories of Kenny Dalglish, get in touch." And I wrote his a crank letter, and it never saw the light of day. And it's kind of ironic because that spurred me on later years to actually write a book about Kenny Dalglish's time at Celtic. But I remember being a bit miffed at the time, thinking, "I've bought every one of their fanzines, by the way, for about 12 years or something like that." I says, and the bastards haven't printed my letter.
Oh, I know.
So,
yeah, that's us.
Yeah. It was a kind of, you used to get a lot of people saying that. "Did you see that what I sent in?" Aye, but we'll try and get it in and all that. But we were going to the games and going to Bevy and all that. And the rest of the.
And here was all the guys think he's been an organised.
Organised? That's the word you would never use. That's an adjective you would absolutely. I mean, having the nerve to criticise the board and stuff.
I was a guy said to me, "Not if you want." "Oh, he's fucking toss man for uni and all that. And off schemes and all that." And I'm like, "Well, it's Royston and Drumcharlton, no fucking scheme here."
Okay, what the hell do you want? I don't know what scheme you're from. He's for the Drum, I'm for Royston.
No, I know he's not mentioning it anyway.
I'm for Sims Hill. It's just say Castlemilk, it's not a scheme, what can I tell you?
Lower Castlemilk.
So, the thing is, dark days came, and you know, in the early 90s, it's horrendous. My son goes through these record books, and he'll say, "Dad, 1992, we finished fifth, or whatever. You looked at the cup with Falkirk," and you think to yourself, it is hard now that things have gone so well to look back and see how depressing it was. But I do have to say this, I'm not being fawning here, but the humour that you had at the time kept the support going in some ways, because, as I said there, there was a collective. You know, people could join in with you and buy the fanzine and think, "Thank God I'm not the only one that feels like this." So were you aware of the fact that you became a vehicle for possibly overturning the board?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, the thing about the collective misery, I think, is important. You know, I mean, remember the Hampden season? It was dreadful, but you were going with your mates, and there was a sense of, you know, togetherness about it, I think. Overturning the board, I think, by that time there was all kinds of things going on. There was all kinds of rumours. There was people getting in touch.
Willie Wilson, mind?
Willie Wilson was the guy who, yeah. But in the meantime, you know, at the same time, Michael Kelly phoned me. I don't know how he got my number, but he phoned me up and he said, "Come down." I was at the office right across the road. from here, from the Admiral, and he showed me all these plans and whatnot, and blah blah blah. And then next day, 2 days later, Brian Dempsey gets in touch, and he shows me all these all different plans and stuff. So I think they knew there was something in the wind, but there was. I'm not sure there was something like, you know, we're going to tip them over the edge, or we're going to be the guys who do it, because as Joe says, you know, by that time, more activist people had got involved, Willie Wilson, Save Ourselves, I think was the first
Save Ourselves. I remember going to a meeting in the Shettleston,
that's right,
Town Hall or Burn Hall, Joe Beltrami and Jim Craig gave terrific speeches, and again it was heartwarming to think that, you know, the place is full of the gunnels.
It was packed, and
I think the after that, but I don't know how that fell through actually, but then Matt came along with it.
Well, Brendan Sweeney came along. Brendan Sweeney did his thing. He was the main man behind Angus Save Ourselves.
I think the beauty about all that was, even through the hard times, was we were at age, we had good times seeing Celtic, hard times obviously as well, so we had a wee bit of hope in our hearts, not to quote us all. And I think it was a kind of beautiful thing that There was a kind of good collective of fans that all thought the same kind of way about how the club should be, and not believing what was said in the boardroom and what they were putting it to us. So there was a cracking collective of folk there, and it was just to be lassoed in into one group, and obviously it did with Celts for Change and all that. Obviously you see other clubs and they just can't do it.
The hardest thing ever was the boycott.
The boycott
was awful, because I remember Joe was one of the first ones to, in our group, race the boycott. And I remember standing at the turnstiles with him, and he's going, "I'm not going in," and not quite believing he wasn't going in.
Well, I was on the Govan Emerald at the time, and we were running a full bus to home games. And our bus convener is a guy called Tony Ford, who's well known in Govan. And Tony had a meeting the Saturday before the Kilmarnock game, was a Wednesday night at boycott. And Tony says, if there's enough members wanting to go, we're on a bus, because we're a democracy. If the guys want to go, and I swear, maybe about 35, maybe 40 guys that were in the pub, only two put their helmet on to go. And common sense prevails, you don't run a bus for two people. Now, I found it hard. I'm actually proud now that I didn't go, because I did find it hard, but afterwards I felt a sense of pride, well, I've done my bit. And then it was difficult to gauge how many turned out, because the old board says it was 11,000, and then
the turnstile
and it was only maybe like 8,500 or something. And if you believe what you read in books and recollections, it was the guy who was the Bank of Scotland opened the paper up the next day, and when he saw it, he says, "No, this is just went far enough." So in some small way, you know, no going did help to overthrow them.
Hilariously, that night I not only got a free ticket for the main stand, which I didn't use, I've still got it, but they opened the turnstile, they opened the gates at the end of the game, and I went in, I saw the goal, it was the last minute goal.
John Collins.
Yeah, it was a deflected free kick, so I boycotted, but still managed to see the goal, which is quite cool.
We had a banner at the Jungle Lands before.
You and Brendan had a banner from Jungle
Lands. I'd done a banner, it's do the honourable thing,
walk away,
resign.
Resign was the big
word. Do the honourable thing, resign, just put it right on the half.
Actually, there's a guy who I don't know, but I do owe an apology to, because I am on two or three of the Celtic Histories videos holding up the banner that sort of has, you know, Glasgow's miles, Celtic's miles worse, whatever. And I'm only holding it up because we turned up at the Dundee game after Brady had resigned, and these guys were standing there protesting, and I'd been out the night before and turned up with a rolling sausage, and this guy was holding up the banner, and he'd helped write the banner. And I thought, that smells great, where do I get it? It's over there. And he ran off to get it, and I held up the banner, and then Michael Kelly showed up. So this guy should be on all the videos, but I'm on it because he's on the way to get a bite to eat. So
you were a substitute.
Apologies, whoever that is, I stole your place in history.
But you know, the good times were to come. You know, Fergus took over in the spring of 1994. So in terms of the fanzine, was it the same after that? Because you didn't really have a bogeyman in the terms of the Michael Kellys and the Chris Wrights. So what was the feeling then?
That's right. And the targets change, you know, you set your targets on other things, you know, then it becomes a kind of external targets like the press and you know, the mainstream media and all that mm-hmm. kind of thing, as opposed to kind of try to depose something so negative. You're trying mm-hmm. to actually support something that, I mean, somebody would have said, well this is what you wanted, isn't it? Why wouldn't you support it? You can't just be totally negative about something. Mm-hmm.
You still
all the
keep
time.
A crosshair on the inside, because I remember George writing an mm-hmm. article when the stadium was first planned, saying 60,000 is too many.
Yeah, I think most of us thought that.
He wrote an article saying this is unrealistic.
Yeah,
which I think now he accepts.
Because at that time, Ibrox only had 44.
Mm. But it's important to keep that eye on the internal goings on. Mm-hmm. That's an important mm-hmm. part of it.
But also keep your distance from all of these guys, and that includes players.
Yeah.
It includes board members.
Management.
Yeah, mm-hmm. everything. You keep your distance from that. You don't get too close mm-hmm. to them. Mm-hmm. How can you, you know, be friends with these guys or you know, mm-hmm. kowtow to these guys and then the next minute write an article about them or something?
As Andy says, that you know, like Fergus planned it at the 60,000 stadium, and I'll always remember to my dying day. It was a Friday night. It was the last time he could hand in the shares. It was a horrible, pissing wet January night. The team weren't even doing well, you know, and it was incredible. The queue went for it in the Wolford restaurant, all the way down the stairs, out the front door, all the way down Kerrydale Street, round the London Road, just about roughly where the turnstiles bar was. And I remember standing there thinking, oh my God, you know, I can't even avoid standing in the corridor. I thought, no, you've came all this way, you need to do it. So a steward came out and he says, there's such a big queue, he says, that we're going to do it for Saturday and Sunday. So if you don't want to stand in the rain and you want to come back Saturday and Sunday, then you know, by all means come back. Don't worry about it, we'll take your money and your application. But I stood it out and it took me about an hour to get to it. And it was £620, which was a lot of money at the time. Like, people appreciate just how much that was at the time. And there was an old man and woman next to me, and I was sort of earwigging. And the old boy bought £3,000 worth of shares, and he said that it was his party's pension and all that. Yeah, it was humbling.
True. Mm.
And just on the way out the stadium with the front door is, there was a steward there, and it was me and this other guy who I didn't know. And he says, gentlemen, but would you like to see a model of the new stadium? And we went, oh, any bother. And he does, I'm sure it's not Celtic Park in the boardroom, maybe. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly the way that it turned out, the way it is now. You know, the main stand's the only thing, it's no change, and it's got these two big stands behind the goal and the big north stand with the big letter Celtic right in the middle. And we looked at it and it looked awesome, and I turned out to the guy and I went, well, nah, I don't see that, mate. Mm-hmm. No, really, because even I didn't have faith in Fergus to what he did. And it was incredible. Within probably about 20 months that stadium was built.
The true story about that is that in the summer of 93, when the old board was still in charge, Fergus McCann, having brass neck that he did, contacted the old board to ask if he could come inside the stadium to make measurements with his architect. And they knocked him back, obviously. And him and his architect were out in Genefield Street making measurements in the summer of 1993 for that stadium. Right, that's how confident he was
of
getting in charge to do that. He was actually out there, the two of them, doing that.
You should have been doing the canvas line and measured up canvas line.
They didn't have wellies with him.
That is one of the differences between Celtic fans and the other lot, because you know, when he was standing in that muddy, boggy field with drawings of some bizarre spaceship kind of thing, it was laughed off. It was laughed off as ludicrous.
Rightly
this
so.
Is ludicrous. It's ridiculous. And we have always had, I think, a more cynical view of people in charge and all that.
Healthy skepticism, yeah.
You know, absolutely. Never, couldn't believe any of this kind of nonsense.
But I think the difference between us and them is, and they're in a similar situation now, but we were probably 20 odd years ago. But I was speaking to a mate in work, and I says, generally speaking, working class, whether you're Catholic, Protestant, or Celtic Rangers, whatever, working class people were brought up with trade unionism and questioning things and trying to get better rights here and there. Or, you know, I'm 51 now, so maybe my dad definitely had that in him, that he was a fierce trade unionist in the shipyards, and he had that, a mindset that he instilled into me, right, indirectly. I mean, I didn't get indoctrinated, that I think you copy what you see. And you know, when Fergus McCann came along, I remember all the guys were sceptical, and they saying, well, what does he want to come in here for? What's he getting? You know, so we were a wee bit sort of like, wary. You know, beware of this guy. You know, it could be some sort of con man. I mean, you see what's happened at Rangers. I think their mindset has always been, my dad's a Mason and he'll get me in a ship. I don't need qualifications because no funny handshake will ensure that I will carry on the family traditions. Mm. And now that that's died out now, and you know, vast majority of jobs these days, you have to have a talent of some degree to get into it. You're not just going to get it now because your dad's a Mason or because you know, like that's the way things have been, and word of mouth has got you in there. And I think that's why that now they've had all these guys taking over, and never once have is anybody dared to question them.
We've got a very healthy attitude of questioning things that's happening with our club. You know, we don't go screaming fucking for the heavens about it and all that, and it's happened, but we've got a healthy questioning of things that are happening, even right up to now. They've got this entitlement attitude. That's a big difference. I see they think we're entitled to everything, you know, and even though we are fucking far superior to them, we will never take that mantle and think that way.
It's a cultural thing, isn't it?
Yeah, some young boys and all that and their support and all that now. But that's just wee pockets here and there, you know. I've never had that entitlement. We don't want to be them. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be the top dog the way they used to think that, and the way they wanted to be, you know.
At the time that we're talking about, we had, it might seem ridiculous now to say, but we had allies in the press. We had guys like Hugh Keevans, and that might, anybody only knows him and he's radio person. I can assure you that these guys, within a day or two of this Jeff and our bullshit coming out, within a day or two, this had been exposed. This guy, Patrick Nally, had been exposed as a racketeer.
There was
guys working.
It wasn't days, it was hours. Yeah,
the following Wednesday or something on Report in Scotland.
No, it was dust by that Friday.
The guy, there was a documentary about him. He was a racketeer, he was up on charges in America and all the rest of it. Whereas for them it's the opposite. Their press defend them to the hilt.
Chick Young actually said that Craig White was not a convict.
Yeah,
or was not
a criminal.
Was not a criminal. And in fact, because he pled guilty, talked me through that.
It's the opposite. You know, Craig White is a billionaire. That's in print. That was a headline. That's in the papers. With the same diligence, that could have been exposed within the same amount of time as being utter rubbish.
I don't want to bang the drum here, but in Celtic Underground, one of our guys had googled Craig White and put stuff on the website, which ultimately the mainstream media latched on to months later. Now, a bit of research on Google, I'm not saying everything on Google's true, but the point is, he'd went into it, he'd found out what was going on. The very least the press could have done at that point was go like that. But is this guy's background? Is he a billionaire, a millionaire? Is he a con man? But the thing as well is...
This was in the days before Google.
I know.
Jeff and Orr, Patrick Nally, everything was exposed.
And he's right, within a matter of hours,
That was the days of journalism.
People
who are willing to be accountable for what they write. Just now, when you read stuff in the newspapers or online, whatever they're doing, I despair. Mm. You know, you don't want to read the newspaper, you don't want to read these people's opinions because they're invalid as far as I'm concerned. All these so-called sport writers, I know a lot of these guys, and some of them are quite decent guys when you talk to them. Some of them have got really good football knowledge, but there's a total closed door shop there of what you can and cannot say, and none of them are prepared
to put their head above
and go like that. Now what Rangers did fucking die.
The only one I think in the media is getting credibility in is Hugh McDonald. Because on the radio he's been consistent, and in the newspapers he's consistent. He's a good journalist, he's good at what he does, and he also tells it the way it is. He's not willing to bend the
surprisingly enough. I was driving up to Aberdeen Wednesday there for the game, and I heard Willie Miller on the BBC Scotland, and Chick Young was kind of advertising how Souness is going to be on Sunday. They're doing an interview with him and all.
Is it a book
and they played a wee clip and they played it and they came back and Willie Miller just went, what's that all about? You know, he's blaming everybody else for Rangers' demise. It was Rangers' own fault and absolutely ripped him one. Chick Young was getting that high pitch now, that way when you're angry or something, you get that high pitch. Dogs were off fucking running about schemes everywhere, squealing because of it. And it was beautiful radio because somebody just actually said it how it was. It was fantastic. I was like, good on you, Willie Miller.
I didn't think he doesn't have an agenda.
He's not a Celtic man, therefore he's talking.
He's a Rangers man, Aberdeen man, isn't he?
Aberdeen, of course he is.
But and funny, you know, he came out and just went, "When's it on, Chick? Sunday?" Oh, I look forward to listening. Pure sarcasm. I just thought, well. You get a wee snippet like that, and it does kind of give you a wee kind of glow that somebody's actually saying it. But as I said, it's a closed shop. They're not willing to
put their head up
and say, "Look, I'll be the one that says it." Or two or three of them say.
I think the most damning indictment against the whole Ranger situation is look at the newspapers in the day after the liquidation thing happened. When they died, right? They're in the process of liquidation now, but we're getting it there. The day that they ceased trading, if you like. Now, the Herald had it in the front page, the Record had it in the front page, the Sun had it in the front page, there was coffins, there was RIPs, there was, you know, all the rest of the stuff in it, and you know, that's like, I always make a joke about it, that the Bobby Ewan scene for Dallas, when he comes out of the shower, it didn't happen.
And see, to be fair, I don't really want them to be on our side or anybody's side or anything. I wouldn't look, see the way we get absolutely ridiculed. I think it was the Mail or the Record. They actually hired a hearse and drove it by Shelley.
They were making it.
You know what, mate? Try to make it happen. They were all four of us going down. Whereas opposed, and fair play, something I thought was quite right. No, that stuff, but some of the articles and all that I read about Celtic, you know, it was good. It was rattling into the board and what they were basically saying the same things we were all saying. You don't want a test to be on one side or the other side.
You want to have objectives,
of course.
You want the truth, that's all.
You just see the way our situation was back then to what their situation was now, and hell fucking mend them. That's where they're going.
Of kind of exposing the truth, and to go back to, you know, what you were talking about earlier on, it was very, very difficult back in the day to get a hold of Celtic accounts, because Celtic was a private company.
That's right.
And the only people that turned up to meetings was Auntie Adele,
the Grants,
and it was, you know, a wee meeting.
Grants, Kelly's and Whites.
You put your hand up and you had canapes afterwards and a couple of drinks, and that was
very civilised.
That was a meeting. And we had to, George went to company's house or whatever it was, and got, it was actually microfiches which we then had to sort of imprint, and nobody had, I don't think anybody had seen a set of Celtic account apart from Auntie Adele and Chris and Michael and Kevin and all the rest of them, you know. It was very difficult to get that information out, but once it was out, then that was the truth. And nobody's looking for an agenda. You just want the truth. And when you can face the truth, which we did, I think, you know, saw the truth. You saw it written on the wall, 15-foot-high letters. Then you've got to do something about it, not deny it, because then you get into their situation.
Which a guy who's very much a bogeyman still amongst a certain amount of Celtic supporters. Is Kerry Cassidy. Now, this is a guy who was brought in by the old board. He didn't have a certain reputation.
He was a voice piece for the old board, wasn't he?
But the first thing he did was look at the accounts, because he was allowed access to them, and phone the Bank of Scotland and say, "You do not lend these people another penny, because they have no mechanism to pay you back." Now, unfortunately, the Bank of Scotland at that time were under Grant Masters. They decided that they would extend the credit line further, and they also contacted the board to say, "Your chief executive is just undermined." He was a dead man walking from that second. But he did see where this logically ended, which is death.
Terry Cassidy's a name that to conjure with, because I had a meeting with him once, to meet a guy for the Governor Emble, and I can't remember now what it was about, but it was a complaint of some type. Had the game his due, secretary phoned us up and we wrote a letter, and he says, "Mr. Cassidy says if you come up on Sunday, Tuesday afternoon, he'll be pleased to meet with you." So Vigas into his office, and Vigas into his office, and he says, we discussed what we're discussing, right? And Cassidy's it says we've got a great new strip coming out, and as it happened, it was the green and black stripes, which is very popular this day. Yeah. So he didn't bother explaining it to us about what's happening. So the story about Cassidy goes, as I was up to meet Cassidy, and the new strip had come out, it was a green and black stripe one, which was very popular at the time. And although we hadn't seen it yet, and he says it's a cracking strip, and my point to Cassidy was, he says, oh, what colour is it now? That's not unusual, given that we've had yellow and black and lime green and all the other things. And his answer was, royal fucking blue, what colour do you think it is? So that's an indication of how abrasive Cassidy was at the time. So the other thing to bear in mind is with the centenary season and not the view being near it is the Jock Stein bust. So who wants to go ahead with that?
Well, no, that's what I just said, but I had the wee interruption there to get drinks by us in St. Jerry. It was a really important thing, and we'll talk with Sean Fallon. It was just such a great day and meeting an absolute legend like that. But Jerry, you pick up.
Oh, I think it was important that, it was at the time, don't forget, I mean, trying to get inside Celtic Park, inside the stand was anyway. But when they made the new thing and all that, and there didn't seem to be any kind of memorial, as it were, to Jock Stein. So I got in touch with this guy. It's a long story, but I got in touch with this artist guy, Sam McVay, with a view to doing this bust of Jock Stein. And it's magnificent. It really is. Anybody's seen it? It's just absolutely.
So it went to the People's Palace originally.
Because we offered it to Celtic, and Jack McGinn knocked it back on the grounds that we had criticised.
You were a malcontent, Jerry. That was a phrase you used to use. You were a malcontent.
That was a phrase that used to be
unreconstructed.
Used to go ring round the terraces.
That's for sure. Yeah. But he said because of the aforementioned, we had criticised some of Jock Stein's signings and they embarrassed the hoops, and they knocked it back. So Elspeth King at the time was the curator of the People's Palace, and we offered it to her, and she said that they would take it. And Sean Fallon was the guy that unveiled it that day, and eventually Fergus brought it home to where it should be. And that day it was George of the Jungle, actually. Yeah. Remember, yeah, in front of the North Stand. Yeah. Must have been a great day for him. He walked out and he pulled the string, and it's anybody who sees it up close, it's awesome. Actually, it's really awesome.
I've been fortunate enough to get into the front doors of Celtic Park a few times, and that's what hasn't always made a beeline for it, because I always think of that day at People's Palace with Sean, and when he did it and he looked at it and he went, that is fantastic.
It's amazing.
And that was Celtic fans that paid for that, wasn't it? Alright, it went through, not the Celtic fans paid for that. You know, and that mob when they put it in Celtic Park.
I know, it's
so that just tells you a lot.
Sums them up, doesn't it, in many ways.
And it is just beautiful that it's there now. It's a joy every time I see it.
So we're not going to be there forever, I hope.
Well, absolutely.
Forever and ever.
Yes, before
the
boys.
I said to Tony Hamilton, you've got to change the plaque on it to mention Not the View, because it was our subscribers that actually paid for that.
They're duty bound for that. Hopefully they will do that. So we're coming to the end, and all I want to say is, what does the future hold for Not the View in this digital age? You know, what issue are you at now? What number is it?
253 is the next one.
Well, that's
number 253. And I don't know. Who knows? You know what's going to happen? I said the last time that we did a podcast, when we get to 200, we'll see what happens. It's a kind of. It's just a thing that keeps going and going. I'd be loath to give it up.
I've got to say, as someone who stands and sells it, the demographic is moving. Young people, but it's not just like I would have said about 10, 12 years ago, it was people our age who, I used to buy this during the centenary. Young people are buying it now. The demographic is slightly changing because people just appreciate the fact that maybe this isn't such a digital thing and it is a bit more, because we have moved our articles. There are stuff obviously about the current situation with the Scottish football and how Celtic are going and all that, the current things. But there are also stuff about, okay, where was the history of whatever, or maybe it's stuff that isn't covered in the the Celtic Youth, for example. Mm-hmm. There was a series of stuff I started and I'll need to pick up again about the Cup Winners' Cup, because we had a long and inglorious past in that cup, because that was where Rapid Vienna happened, and we had an Atletico Madrid game, and we had a bunch of it, and every possible misfortune that we could have ever encountered visited us in that competition. It's very rare that you have a goalkeeper prodded in the back to take a goal kick quicker by an army unit poking the muzzles of their rifles. So it's a very unusual competition. So that's one thing, and so it's articles like that that I think are going to keep the interest going.
It's because a lot of people want to read about things like that, and because there is a big gap there, but Andy says about famous games and all that, and then obviously there's the modern stuff with the Green Brigade, the police act against fans, criminalisation against fans that we touch, and we're not saying we know everything about it. There is other ones,
but
we highlight it, we bring it there, and we've just recently hit the Twitter and all that, people going, oh, fuck, not they're still there, man, need to buy it again, where can I get it, and all the rest. So there's still
maybe you'll have a wee renaissance this season.
There is a nice wee renaissance, not one to sound too old farty,
but it's also that thing of you bring a perspective to it of, you know what, every one of us around this table was there when we were on our knees, and every one of us appreciates every single trophy and every single
league. I got a letter recently from a guy who said that he was up in the Scottish, whatever it was, you know, and he was looking through the archive, and he said they've got copies of Not in the View from, you know, and he mentioned all the ones who said they don't have this issue and that issue, and it was a very nice letter, because he said you should really send them it, because it's social history, it's the kind of thing that, no, not historians from 100, well, maybe 100 years later, you'll look through the archives and say, what were the people actually saying at the time? Not the guys who write the history books, but the guys.
We said the exact same thing about the Shamrock. I mean, you and I sitting looking through the Shamrock and going, criticising Yogi Hughes and all the rest of it. And you know, that's great reading and all that. You know, just getting a feel of what it was like.
A flavour of it.
For guys like us.
And apart from anything else, you know, if we suffered it, why shouldn't you suffer it? We suffered it. My daughter, who doesn't even go to the game, has seen us beating Barcelona, right?
Exactly.
You know, my son, who, you know, to be fair to him, has been going since the age of six or whatever, is pissed off because we don't get into the Champions League. We've got to play in the UEFA Europa League or something like that, you know.
It's a hard life, isn't it?
And you're going, is that what you're complaining about? Is that really what you're miserable about?
Tell him if ever get beat with Airdrie penalties in the League Cup, the Broomfield
or worse. I mean, it could come up worse
than you that, Nigel.
You know, that Motherwell in the Scottish Cup at third part and things like that. You know,
so we've suffered it. You suffer it as well.
But my nephew grew up at the time when Rangers won 9 in a row. And he was at the age of young Justin, right? Yeah. Got to the games, got to see it. For 9 solid years, he never knew anything other than reading about Celtic winning in history books or watching old videos. And see, when we won, I couldn't, the delight in his face and all that. And then when we won the League Cup, and it was McGeady and Odie scored, I mean, coming out, and this guy behind went like that, he goes, it's only a League Cup. And my nephew turned and went, I've never seen Celtic
win
beat
the League Cup,
Rangers in a fucking league, any cup. And he says, and I fucking treasure that. And some fans forget,
I think especially these days when you think about, you know, we're sitting here tonight, and I don't know when your podcast is going out, but we're sitting here tonight and we could go to the game tomorrow, and if Celtic don't get beat, we have equaled a record which has stood since 1915 or 1916, right?
Astonishing.
And it's amazing.
100 years.
It's amazing, right? And if we don't get beat tomorrow and we go one further, we've actually broken that. We are living in historic times. We appreciate it because we have had to go there through the bad times and all that. And I think you've got to hold on to that. You know, hold on to your angst.
Absolutely.
Well, I think in that sort of happy topic, we'll call it a halt there, because if anybody's listening, we're in the Admiral Bar and we're bursting for a drink. And if we were to turn this on maybe in about 2 hours, you'll hear us all singing Boys of the Old Brigade or something like that.
I just
So it just remains for me to say, on behalf of the Celtic supporters, thanks for everything you've done through the years. You've entertained us. You're definitely a part of the Celtic folklore, Celtic history, and many, many happy years more to
and can I just say, Stephen, one of the things that is so gratifying is that a lot of the things that we came up with over the years, like the sieve, have become part of the
parlance,
the culture, the lingua franca, and that is brilliant. And the best, the proudest moment of my life was when I went up. I took my boy up to the Hampden Museum, and there's a note of you in one of the glass cases, and he said, "Dad, that's your magazine in there."
It's wonderful,
fantastic.
So
fantastic.
It's
what can you say?
May it last for many more years. So thanks very much, boys.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for having us.
Cedric, how are you feeling ahead of tomorrow night's game?
I think I'm feeling pretty excited. I think the team is excited too. We are always looking forward to play that kind of game, you know. It's a big moment for us, and we've got that. We want to actually do better than we did away over there, you know. So it's a chance for us to show everything.
Yeah, how do you approach it given the game you had against
Bayern
over the 2 weeks ago?
We know that over there we didn't actually play the game that we wanted to play, you know, and I think it was a bit frustrated for us. We finished the game and we weren't happy with ourselves, but then tomorrow we have the chance to do it in front of our fans, you know, and I think it's a big opportunity for all the players and for all of us, you know, and we prepared very well this week, and we're just looking forward for that.
Cedric, how much defensively do you need to improve the performance from Munich if you're to stand a chance of getting something from this game?
I think it's not just a point of defensive. I think it's just the whole general. We have to try to play our game, you know, not be afraid to, because let's be honest, we've got nothing to lose, we've got everything to show, you know. We're playing against one of the biggest teams in Europe. Players have been in the World Cup finals. You know, it's a big opportunity for us to go there and just show what we can do against them. You know, of course, I mean, it will be difficult, and then we just need to be on top of our game, and that's from the goalkeeper to the strikers. You know, we just need to work as hard as we can, not be afraid, play our game, and then see what happens.
Lewandowski and Müller are both out. That makes your life a bit easier?
We know how good Lewandowski is. I'm not even going to talk about Müller because we know about Müller, you know. Two key players for the team, and then they got a big squad like we have, and then I'm sure they will find a way to replace them, but that doesn't mean that it's gonna make the game easier for us. Two key players not there, then okay.
Didit, you've got 3 group games left, 2 of them at home here. What do you think is realistically possible for Celtic?
as we said from the beginning, the target was to play in Europe after Christmas, after December. Now we have 3 points. Bayern's got 6 points. Everything's still possible, you know. We're playing at home, we've got 2 games left, 3 games left, 2 at home, 1 away. Everything's still possible. We know how difficult it will be from the beginning, but then we know that anything can happen. And we never know what happened after a win tomorrow, and then everything can happen after that.
You had a match recently up at Aberdeen where things seemed to click quite well. Did you sense that the team's gelling, coming together just at the right time? Because obviously the European level is at a step up yet again.
Yeah, of course, European level is a step up. We all know it. But we've been preparing very well, playing well all together. The game against Aberdeen was outstanding, you know. We just want to keep on going, you know. Show what we can do. I mean, in here, everybody knows what we can do, you know. I mean, even after the
the Aberdeen game, people were saying we hope we can play like this in the Champions League, you know, it's a chance for us, and you just make a choice because we know we can do it.
The players have often spoken about how different this game will be from the game over in Munich. How much does the home crowd really affect the players, or how much can it affect the away team at Celtic Park?
I mean, I can only tell what other players have said when they come in. They came here, you know, they say that how affected it can be with the crowd behind us, you know, all the noise and everything. But then, playing with the 12 men is always best, is always good for us, you know. It can only be positive for us on the pitch. And then, of course, we all players, we know how to deal with the pressure. But it's always a plus for us.
The manager said last time that he wanted you to go into the game with no fear. Do you still feel that way even after what happened in Munich?
Yeah, I mean, manager said it because I think it was disappointing because he knows exactly what we can do. You know, he was expecting us to go there and just show no fears, and we didn't do that. So I think it was a bit disappointing, and we all understand, you know, because before the game we were all excited to go there and we didn't show what we should have done, you know. So tomorrow is a chance for us to show the opposite because we know our qualities, we know what we can do. And we just hope that tomorrow we will be able to show what we can do in front of our fans, in front of everybody, and that'll be just a good thing, a positive for us.
In Scottish Premiership, there is no such opposition as Bayern Munich or PSG. Is that a problem to prepare this kind of game?
It's definitely difficult, but then as a football player, you just never know. You just know that you can play against one. You have to play against the best teams, you know. Of course, on the pitch, you realize okay, it's going quicker than usual, but then you just need to adapt, and that's the Europa League level, and that's the level you want to be. We want to be playing on that level in the league, you know. So that's why we should be excited to play against this kind of team and just up our level.
So the two games against PSG and Bayern, the previous games, can be a preparation for this one. Maybe you've learned things that you can use on the pitch tomorrow.
We learn every day, every time we play against them, against PSG, Bayern, even Anderlecht, we learn every time, you know. And that level is definitely not easy, but then we it's a level where you see everybody plays on TV, you watch the semi-final, you watch the qualifier, you watch the final, you watch Ronaldo, you watch Messi. Now tomorrow we play against Robben, Ribéry, or whatever, you know, the big names, you know. And for us, it's always a big joy to be on the pitch and just to up our level, try to understand the game, and if it goes wrong, just take the positive of it and just go for it again.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast. The music was specially chosen for Average Joe Miller of Not The View. First up was Hot 8 Bass with their cover of Ghost Town, and then we've got The Beat with their cover of Can't Get Used To Losing You. So that is another podcast with St Anthony and the Not The View guys celebrating their 30th anniversary. There'll be more podcasts along soon. As I record this, we've got the Bayern Munich game tomorrow night. Four-goal victory sees us leading the head-to-heads. So I'm sure we'll be heading for that and celebrating that on Wednesday morning. Anyway, enough of me. Enjoy the podcasts. There'll be more along soon. This is me, Harry Brady. That was him, St Anthony, saying good night and God bless. Good night. No matter what I try to do, gonna spend my whole life through loving you.
to take your place. Yes, that I'm